I'd give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd
And of course, Ella Fitzgerald's three little words she's talking about is Woe Is I, which is the title of Patricia T. O'Connor's first book. There have been a number of others since. Woe Is I, Jr. We've had Origin of the Species. I'm not doing them in order. you want to give us the full list?
Woe Is I, Woe Is I, Jr., Words Fail Me, You Send Me, and Origins of the Species.
Which broke the mold and became a four little words.
Yeah.
When Patricia is here, we take your calls at 212-433-9692. You can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. The subject is the language in all of its various manifestations.
Mm-hmm, and all its glory.
And the word disgruntled has come up in the past. People wondering about some of those words that sound like they are variants on another word.
Right. They say, like, what is chalant if there's a nonchalant? What is plussed if there's nonplussed? And sometimes we adopted the negative form into English and we never bothered to adopt the positive form as with
like
nonchalant.
Well, what is the French? Does the French say chalant?
I don't know if they still say that, but it means warm or enthused. Mm-hmm. So if you're nonchalant, you're cool towards something. But sometimes what looks like a negative front on a verb really isn't negative, and that's the case with disgruntled. But people have lately been using gruntled, and I'm often getting mail about this, including a listener who wrote a couple of weeks ago about, where is gruntled? I'm looking for it in the dictionary and I can't find it. Well, you will find it in the OED. The word you find today is seen mainly in humorous writing, and it's intended as a tongue-in-cheek opposite to disgruntled. And it's a relatively new invention. In fact, the first person to use it in writing was one of my favorite authors, P.G. Wodehouse. In his novel, The Code of the Worcesters, in 1938, he wrote, "He spoke with a certain what is it in his voice, and I could see that if not actually disgruntled, he was far from being gruntled." And since then, we've had gruntled as a more or less humorous word. You don't see it often, but occasionally, to mean it, put in a good humor. But the truth is that gruntled is descended from a very old verb, to gruntle, that used to be part of the language around the early 1400s. It was a regular verb, to gruntle, and it meant to grunt like a pig. Mm-hmm. And it came from the word grunt. It was
so
a diminutive.
You're showing dissatisfaction.
Yes, yes. First, it just was used for pigs or swine. Then later, it was used of people to mean they were grumbling or dissatisfied if they were gruntled or if they gruntled. So that word has been around since about the 1500s, to gruntle.
But then, how does the disc get attached to it?
Well, gruntle became such a popular word that people felt it needed an intensifier, so dis was added as an intensifier. You see, it's not always a negative prefix, mm-hmm. as in dispute. It's just it's not always negative.
Well, there's the word pute.
Well, there we don't actually use pute, but it means to be divided, actually. But anyway, back to gruntled or disgruntled. It was actually an intensified form of gruntle, to gruntle, like to grumble or grunt like mm-hmm. a pig. And that was the word that we had for centuries. Gruntle fell out of use until P.G. Wodehouse came along and reinvented gruntled with a different meaning, to mean to put into a good humor. So that's one of the fascinations of English, I think, that a lot of these things that appear new, appear to be inventions, actually were once in the language. But I like gruntled to mean happy, because P.G. Woodhouse has a couple of characters, a couple of aristocratic noble or semi-noblemen who keep pigs. And they like going off on a Sunday to the sty and scratching the pigs on their back, and the pigs grunt in satisfaction, and you can just tell they're thoroughly gruntled. So it what goes around comes around.
But there are also words that start off meaning one thing and then take on a totally opposite meaning in the English language, like fulsome.
Yes, yes. Fulsome, which started out meaning disgusting or
I know. I think it started off meaning good, and then it became.
Oh, it did?
I think that it became disgusting, and now people are starting to use it again in the original meaning.
To mean full.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Well, the same has happened with disinterested and uninterested. They've traded places many times over the centuries, so it's really rather meaningless now to criticize people for using disinterested in the wrong way.
I'm uninterested in that whole conversation. Cause it's,
you sense there's a schism there, right?
I do. There are people who are still upset about less and few. I'm one of them. I'm not upset. I don't care if other people do it. I just won't do it myself.
Well, fewer is being used for fewer and fewer occasions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We hear it less often.
Yes. We do.
So is there anything else we want to say about this?
Well,
I did want to throw in one
little thing my eye happened to fall on the other day that I thought was so interesting. You know the old saying, heads I win, tails you lose?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you think it's fairly recent?
Yes.
It's been traced back to at least 1739.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes, it is, because that sounds like a modern idea.
It does. It took me a while to hear it.
Okay. Well, my voice is changing, finally. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate here with Patricia T. O'Connor, author of a number of books on the English language and a regular contributor to our show. We take your calls at 212-433-9692. When she stops by, we also look at your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's just go down the line and try to make these questions as quick as possible, because there are a lot of people who are calling in. Lawrence from Plainfield, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. Hello, Pat.
Hi.
I have a question about how people are using the word bombastic, B-O-M-B-A-S-T-I-C. I tend to think, I don't know if you're hearing the same thing, people use it like... meaning, like, they'll use it like when somebody's talking and saying I think they mean shouting at somebody.
Uh-huh.
And I tend to think that the word, based on dictionaries that I've consulted, it means using, like, high-sounding or inflated language, pompous language. I would make the equivalent of, to like, the character Charles Emerson Winchester on MASH would speak in a bombastic way.
Yeah, the dictionary agrees with you.
Now, what's funny about that is I'm reading, like, a friend of mine brought a book she was reading, and they referred to, like, music being bombastic. And I would say, is there an editor or copy editor at that publishing?
No, that is correct as well. Usually is the, you know, like, the kind of overpowering music that you get in certain kinds of movies. Where they're kind of overexpressive, intended to make you feel whatever the movie maker wants you to feel. So, but I think that grows out of the same thing, grandiloquent.
It's principally used of speech, but it can also be applied to other things. And I see here from the dictionary that it's actually, etymologically, it means cotton batting.
Really?
Padding.
So it's padding. Right. It's when people use big words
to be
impressive.
Pad things out.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your call. And we go now to Beryl from Manhattan. Hi, Beryl. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just with a friend who was referring to someone as a voracious reader. Mm. And I would use the word as eating, connected with eating only, not with reading. So I'm wondering...
I've heard voracious writer or reader all my life.
I think it's being used in a figurative way. You know, we don't just use all words literally, we use them figuratively too. Like you might say, that was a delicious novel.
Mm-hmm.
You don't mean you were actually tasting it.
That would be very good for a voracious reader to have
yes.
a delicious novel.
Yes.
So that's the poetry. That's the poetry of the English language. We employ those mm-hmm. kinds of things more than a lot of other languages.
Mm-hmm. I think we do. I'm not sure of that.
I'd like to believe it. Our next caller is George. Hi, George from Manhattan. You're on the air.
Hi. Question about the phrase often used in the legal profession, as per, two words. It would seem that per means as. So that probably seems to be redundant.
Did you just write to me recently on this subject?
No, I did not.
Somebody just wrote to me about this. According to the OED, as per is the way that per is usually used in English. So even though it on the surface it seems redundant, that's how it's basically used in English. As per, meaning according to.
Mm-hmm. So.
Or in line with.
So then that's the correct thing.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with as per.
Okay, unless you got Asperger's. we go now to John from Paramus. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Mayor Bloomberg was recently overheard giving his opinion about the presidential election in a private conversation, and someone said someone was eavesdropping on his conversation. Can you tell me what your origin of eavesdropping, and does eaves really drop? Or?
Well, I would think it would mean hiding under the eaves. I haven't researched this, but let me see what the dictionary says.
But of course, that is listening in.
Listening in, right, eaves. It's a nice term.
Yeah.
Eavesdrop, to listen secretly. Probably a back formation, one who eavesdrops. From eavesdrop, a place where water falls from the eaves. Well?
That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But maybe you're just skulking around, hiding under the eaves and getting dripped on.
Serves you
right.
Steve in Rockville Center writes, constitute, institute, prostitute, destitute. These words are so different, yet they share the same root. What is statute mean?
I would assume that statute is a noun-forming element. That's just my off the top of my head.
But it is interesting. Prost, inst, mm-hmm. const, dest.
And it also is a verb. Those are all verbs, too.
Yeah.
So maybe they're verb-forming elements. I can't tell you that off the top of my head.
Okay, well, we will save that for our next show.
Okay.
And we will go to Dan from Forest Hills. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you? I'm a longtime fan of the segment. My question is regarding the use of the word loan and lend. Mm. For instance, I've heard a commercial on the radio that says GE Capital will loan you the money. Now, mm-hmm. I've always known loan to be the noun and to lend to be the verb. And this is very common, and everybody seems to get this wrong, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, those are the traditional distinctions, that a loan is a noun and lend is a verb. And you're kind of on the same side as my husband, Stuart, who hates to hear those used differently. But in fact, loan is properly used as a verb now.
It is.
Yes,
Is it something that's developed recently?
It's developed over about the last 60 years
or so. 60 years. Okay, that's long enough.
By common usage, it's going to eventually be part of the language like everything else.
It's already part of the language, yeah, to loan. Yeah.
It rubs me the wrong way, really. It's not neither a borrower nor a loaner be, you know.
Well, thank you so much for being alone by the telephone.
But, you know, when you take your car in to get fixed and they lend you a car to use, mm-hmm. it's often called a loaner. Which implies a verb.
Yeah, they could have said a lender.
They could have said that.
Although.
But the lender is the one who gives, so I don't know.
Neither.
You'd be all tied in knots.
We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will be taking more of your calls to Patricia T. O'Connor. at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Stay with us.
Give to hear those three little words.
Mel Torme, who used to be called a velvet fog, which is something similar to what we were talking about before, about being a voracious reader.
Right.
Obviously, the voice wasn't velvet and it wasn't a fog, and yet we understand perfectly well what that meant.
Right.
So, should we take some more calls?
Let's do.
Okay, our next caller is, I'm sorry.
I know him.
JJ from Manhattan. Hi, JJ.
Hi there. I had a quick question about more than and over. So you read a lot of companies talking about, we made more than $20 million last year, or we made over $20 million last year. Mm-hmm. Which is it supposed to be?
Well, I can tell you that when I was a copy editor, I know that we weren't supposed to use over with numbers. We were only supposed to use it for physically being above something. But it's a completely mythological rule. There's no foundation for it at all.
They seem to be perfectly
over and more than. They're
equal.
Yeah, they're fine. They're both fine. So it's okay to say he was doing over 40 miles an hour,
yeah,
or he was doing more than 40 miles an hour, either one.
Okay. Michael from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My grandma was a copy editor for many years in New York and continues to be so in a freelance capacity. And she always reminds me of various mistakes I make. And there's one in particular that's kind of a nuisance. She reminds me of the fact that it's not the place one hangs his hat is not one's stomping grounds, but rather stamping grounds.
Stamping grounds, right. That's
and
how.
There's a similar problem as well. When I'm, I should be champing at the bit, not chomping at the bit. But
right.
Everyone seems to say the incorrect version. I'm just curious what you had to say about it.
Well, it's true. She's right. I wouldn't say other people are wrong for using those other versions, but the originals are stamping grounds and champing at the bit. The reason for champing is when a horse is sort of chewing on his bit in his mouth, rolling it around in his teeth, that's called champing. It's not chomping. It's not biting down necessarily. It's just rolling it around in his mouth.
But you know, you can't bite down. You could only bite up. As my dentist has pointed out to me many times.
Oh, well, if you had your chin on a level surface and you were chewing, the top of your head would have to go up and down, though, wouldn't it?
You
it's all
do
a matter
not
of perspective.
Bite down.
Okay.
But people say it all the time, and you know what? It's perfectly fine.
Yes, yes.
Okay, George, you want to talk about the word two?
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. This has been driving me crazy for about 20 years. I can never get an answer to this. The sentence, in the English language, there are three ways to spell the word two. How would you spell two in that sentence?
Oh, well, there are three ways to spell two?
Right.
Yeah, well, there's T-O, T-O-O, and T-W-O.
Well, yeah, but if you were to
write
that, you can say that. In speech, it makes sense.
Right.
But in writing, you would have to give it phonetically. Say, if you use the international phonetic symbols for how two sounds. Because if you wrote it, you'd have to choose one of those ways in spelling it.
Actually, there's a fourth way, T-U, as in
oh,
A2 Brute.
Oh, yes. Well, that's not really in English.
Yeah, but it's Shakespeare. And anything Shakespeare wrote was English.
Forsooth.
But the, what George brings up a real problem, which mm-hmm. is that the language is also the something that is we understand through sound. So
yes.
the word READ and RED are the pronounced the same, and yet
sure.
they are totally different.
Sure.
So how would George say there are two ways to say red?
Well, again, you if you were using letters to write that sentence out, you couldn't legitimately do it without choosing a way to print it.
And
so
then there's
unless you used phonetic symbols.
And then it would be confusing if you
yes.
read that as there are two ways of saying read.
Yes.
Which is spelled the same as red.
Right, right.
So life is very complicated.
It
That's
is.
Part of what makes the English language so much fun, right?
Yes, I
And
think
the reason
so.
That you come back week after week and
yeah.
we have so many things to talk about. Adam wrote in that the statute suffix comes from the Latin statuere, meaning to establish.
To establish, yeah. I was poking around in the dictionary here while we were talking, and I did find that the statuere meaning to set up or establish. That's probably where the toot
so
part
where did,
comes
I'm
from.
Not sure how prostitute works in that regard.
Yeah, I'm
Are
not sure.
Are you establishing your
yourself
pro,
as a pro?
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
We won't go there.
I guess we could have an amateur stoot as well. Muriel in the financial districts writes, I think eavesdropping has something to do with the whispering wall effect of the eaves where sound travels further than you would expect it to. You can find the sweet spot to listen in.
Oh.
That really does make sense.
Yes,
but,
it does.
But it may be a back formation, right?
Could be. It could be.
But I like it.
Yeah.
Another person wants to know, Mel in Hartford, what's the difference between continual and continuous?
Well, there is a difference. One is steadily without stopping, and the other one is repeated. And I can never remember which is which.
Well, continuous is without stopping, and continual.
Okay, continual would be then repeated with breaks in between.
It's continually annoying.
I think the distinction is kind of useless by this time, the distinction between those words. That's just my feeling.
A listener, I think that we've talked about this before, asks if being gruntle is related to being couth. No.
Well, it's one of those words that doesn't seem to have an opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But, unkempt is another.
Yes.
Inscrutable. You can't say, oh, he's so scrutable, I can see right through him.
we go now to Ben from Manhattan. Hi, Ben, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, thanks for taking my call. Just bouncing back to Woodhouse and an opportunity to discuss it, maybe a little off topic, is I love the names of his characters in his books.
Oh, yeah.
Like Pomona Grindle, a writer, or Bingo Little. And one of my bosses, who was a real handful, a big jerk, he came to be known in my house as Stilton Cheesewright.
Oh, Stilton Cheesewright is a good one. I also like Gussie Finknottle.
Sphinkbottle, absolutely. Yeah, Augustus Finknottle, absolutely. Seppings the butler and Cheese. So they're all.
Honoria Glossop.
Honoria Glossop.
And her father, Puppy Sir
Glossop,
Roderick
absolutely.
Glossop.
Percy Goringes, who even acknowledges that's what he's called. So a little off topic, but enjoyable nonetheless.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we could ask why his name is pronounced Woodhouse when it's W O D E.
Looks like Woodhouse. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Perfect.
This is another thing that you find in England. The upper classes mm-hmm. often pronounced words differently than they seemed to be by spelling. It was a way they distinguished whether you were one of us.
Uh huh. If you say Cholmondeley, you're not in
you
the club.
You have to say Chumley. another listener, Mag in New Jersey, points out some other words that we could talk about. Immediate, because mm-hmm. mediate does not mean the same thing. Debunk, disheveled.
Disheveled.
Which, of course, would be disheveled, would be helved, right? Heveled, disheveled.
I'm not
heveled.
Sure.
It would be heveled.
How about indomitable or insipid? No one is sipid,
no.
is he? Or nondescript. Well, you could say he's describable, but not he's descript. Unassuming, he's assuming. Unbeknownst, is there a benounced?
Well, he's
immaculate. How about maculate?
Mm. Yes.
A maculate conception as opposed to an immaculate conception.
I don't want to get theological here.
I'll get struck by lightning. Indefatigable, defatigable, inclement, clement. Actually, I've heard people jokingly talk about clement weather or incapacitated. So there are a lot of those good ones.
Marge from Chelsea is calling with a question that we've heard before, but it just does not go away.
You've heard it before?
Well, sure, because people are confused by it, Marge.
Yeah, and the people who graduate schools and colleges.
All right.
Shouldn't it be graduate from?
Yeah, or you can. There are three proper ways, I suppose, acceptable ways to say that. I graduated from college. I was graduated from college, and the school graduated me. But you don't generally say, I graduated college. That's not quite standard yet. It probably will be kosher someday.
But I think it's regional in the same way that standing in line.
Yes. I never heard I graduated college until I moved to the East. And I heard it about the same time I heard standing online.
Stu in Manhattan writes, perhaps the most misused word in the English language is peruse. I'm not sure it's the most misused word. Its actual definition is to examine carefully, thoroughly, or at length. It does not,
does not mean
to browse over or or finger through as it is usually used.
There's something about peruse that sounds casual. I don't know what it is, but for some reason, it's tempting to use it to just mean casually riffling through a book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really what peruse was intended to mean.
So sometimes the sound actually affects the way we understand a word.
Yeah.
Cece from Queens, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about something that's been driving me crazy since the 1990s. It's what I call superfluous ofs.
Wait. So for the last, how many years? 90s. Over 25 years, maybe 30 years. It's been driving you crazy?
Let's say 15. Not quite that bad. I don't think I heard it in 1991. Okay.
Misused of?
Yeah. People saying it's not that big of a deal. It's not that large of a dog.
It fell off of a truck.
Excuse me?
It fell off of a truck.
Oh, well, of course it fell off of a truck, yeah. But, you know, not
right.
There was something I just saw in print the other day, not so great of a chance.
Oh, dear.
I mean, it's getting to be used in it's spreading.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
I think I've figured that one out, though, it appeals to people. I think it's phrases like, we had a heck of a good time, or it was a hell of a storm, or it was a whale of a party.
Mm-hmm.
We always say of a in those cases.
Mm-hmm. But not in others up until recently.
Well, what happens.
Those are pretty much standard.
Things spread in the English language.
Yeah, but in those, you're making apposites.
I like concision. I mean, if you don't need it, don't use it.
Well, we have another caller, Elizabeth, I think, who has a similar kind of problem with another locution. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Well, I had two problems, so I don't know which one you're referring to.
The try-and.
Yes. Well, you hear it all the time. People say, I'm going to try and do something.
I'd like to defend that one. I think that there are grounds for defending that one. For example, you say, go and see who's at the door.
But you could say, go to see who's at the door.
Pardon me?
Go to see who's at the door.
You could.
If you say, you probably will do that.
But it's just as idiomatic to say, go and see.
That I can understand, because you're going, and then you're going to see who's at the door. Mm-hmm. But what are you trying?
Well, you're making...
In the try-and situation. What are you trying?
Well, you have a point there. But I still think it's becoming acceptable idiomatic English to try and do this. And I did some research, and I found a lot of examples going back a couple of hundred years. It's not a new thing. often when we when we just notice something, we think it's brand new, but that's what it's called, the recency illusion. There's a linguist named Arnold Zwicky.
As when people have corrected a guest on the show for saying none, as in the singular, even though
it's usually singular,
or in the plural, right?
Oh no, I'm sorry. It's usually
whatever,
plural.
Even though
it's
no one. But it goes back to the 13th century,
oh,
or something
exactly.
like that.
Yeah.
Pat, I always introduce you as the author of a number of books, but I forget to mention that you also have a blog. And people can ask Pat questions directly by writing into her blog, mailbox@grammarphobia.com, or they also can just see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners at grammarphobia.com. They've often inspired our conversations, haven't they?
Yes, and people write in who can't get through sometimes.
So if you didn't get through today, you can always send your question into mailbox@grammarphobia.com. And you can also wait until July 18th when Patricia T. O'Connor will be joining us once again on the show. I'm looking forward to it.
I am too.